This week on Making Contact.
Greenpeace has ships, and I'm a sailor. And the good thing about ships is that we can come in areas where you otherwise cannot come.
As I say, fundamentally, we will never support fracking. We have to get off fossil fuels, and we have to start here.
Women are gaining influence as leaders throughout the world, fighting for peace, justice, the environment, and civil society. In this program, we profile women of Greenpeace, the legendary eco-activist organization. Hetty Geenan is first mate on the Greenpeace ship Rainbow Warrior. Layla Dean leads the campaign against fracking. And Lila Williams connects Greenpeace with indigenous communities, women's groups, and people of color. I'm Sandina Robbins, your host this week on Making Contact. This program is produced by the Women Rising Radio Project.
One blue sky above us, one ocean lapping all our shores, one earth so green and round, who could ask for more?
Since 1971, Greenpeace and its ships have been making waves around the world, navigating the dangerous territory of man-made destruction and corporate control of natural resources. From the Arctic to the tropics, Greenpeace is emblematic of successful, direct, nonviolent resistance. Media, corporations, and governments have all been the targets of Greenpeace actions in defense of the Earth and all forms of life. In 1985, while protecting coral reefs in the Pacific Ocean, Greenpeace's Rainbow Warrior was bombed by the French government. France was forced to pay for a new ship, which served until 2011. Then a brand new, greener Rainbow Warrior made its debut on the seas, complete with high-tech communications, cranes for dropping inflatable boats, a sophisticated sailing system, and even a helipad for helicopters. This new, custom-built Rainbow Warrior docked in San Francisco in late 2013, and First Mate Hetty Geenan welcomed thousands of visitors to the Greenpeace ship.
I'm from the Netherlands. I started sailing when I was 14 years old. I already wanted to go to sea when I was 15, and actually I do not really know why. I went to sea and became a skipper on the typical Dutch sailing vessels. And I did that for 13 years. But at one point I got sick of sailing with tourists because it didn't challenge me enough anymore. And I thought I wanted to do something with a goal. And then I started with Greenpeace. And actually then was for me the first time that I went to sail all around the world, actually. I think my main reason why I stayed in Greenpeace is my first trip. And I remember we arrived in the Philippines. And in the Philippines, in the past, there was a U.S. airbase. And at one point, the U.S. left the airbase, but they didn't clean up. So close by the airbase was a volcano, and a lot of people were living there. And at one point, the volcano erupted. So the people who were living close to the volcano, they moved, and they moved to the airbase, where the soil was contaminated and the water was contaminated as well. So what happened is that the women got a lot of miscarriages and the children got sick. And when we arrived in the Philippines, we were doing an action against this. I remember the captain driving a forklift in the streets of Manila with a big container full of the soil. And the idea was to put it in front of the U.S. embassy and to say, U.S., clean up your mess. We did it. The captain dropped the container. We were having a human blockade of all the crew members in front of the embassy. The next day, we got a visit of children to the ship. And these were children who had leukemia, were sick. And it was one little girl. Her name was Chriselle. And she was 6 years old. She had leukemia. And she was so happy that the Rainbow Warrior was coming. This was her big dream. So she made a very nice drawing on a sailing boat and her friends visiting the ship. And this drawing was actually the drawing we used for promoting the ship's tour.
in the Philippines. And she came on board, and the same captain, Pete Wilcox, was driving all the children around in port in Manila. Chris L was there sitting in the front, steering, while he was, the medic on board was holding her. And, okay, they finished the tour around the port. And they came back on board, and 2 hours later, she passed away on board. Yeah, this story, I think it's always stayed with me, and I thought, yes, what we do is important, and we need to speak up for people who cannot speak up. And I believe in this, and I want to be part of this.
In 2013, another Greenpeace ship, the Arctic Sunrise, was campaigning to keep multinational corporations out of the Arctic. Activists tried to board a Russian oil platform and hang a Greenpeace banner, then sailed back out to international waters. But the Russian Coast Guard pursued them, detained the ship, and arrested all 30 people on board. This action led to an international outcry and a global standoff. Greenpeace got a whale load of publicity about Arctic drilling and climate change. All but one of the 30 activists were pardoned in a pre-Olympics move by Russian President Vladimir Putin. They were Hetty's friends and colleagues, particularly the captain, Peter Wilcox, who led Hetty's pivotal journey to the Philippines. Hetty awaited her colleagues' freedom, but even more, she supported their mission.
I think people don't know what the Arctic is because they've never been in the Arctic. So they don't know how vulnerable it is. But if you've been there, you get very committed. We were in Greenland with scientists, and they were looking for a glacier and had the coordinates of the glacier. I remember that the pilot said, yeah, we are at the coordinates, and the scientist said to him, but I don't see a glacier at all. And we had to fly much further to find actually the glacier. So the retrieving of the glaciers surprised the scientists as well. And yeah, while I was there, I could see it. So this is a big effect of climate change. When I speak out of myself, I would say that some people see it's climate change and other people still don't see it. They don't want to see it. It's probably too big and too scary to do anything and to face the truth. And at one point I remember that I've been dropped from the helicopter on a glacier. And I was just standing there alone at one point, and it was, I think with 250 kilometers around me, there was nobody. And being there, standing there, and you just feel it, then you become more committed to do this job. I think then you can feel how stupid it is to destroy it. I have been in many campaigns. I've been 5 times to the Amazon, and we were protesting against pig iron, because for making iron out of pig iron, they used charcoal from ancient forest, from the Amazon. And the whole process there was they used slavery. So those two issues were on the agenda. And we blocked a ship from loading pig iron. I think for me this was one of the best actions, because in the end we didn't get arrested. But the end was that we all came to an agreement. We come and sit around the table. And in the end, they said the slavery is not going to happen anymore. And they're not going to use the forest from the Amazon to make the charcoal. So in the end, this was a very successful action. I love my job very much. As a first mate, I think I'm just a spin in a web. I make sure things happen. Driving the ship 8 hours a day when we're at sea. And I'm second in command, so when captain is not there, I'm the captain. On this ship, I really like it when we have wind and we can sail. The nice thing about this ship is that you can sail it with 2 people. It's very nice in the middle of the night with 2 people outside and you're able to sail the ship. It's a great feeling.
And because I love you, I'll give it one more try to show my rainbow rays. It's too soon to die, too soon to die.
Since Senior Greenpeace activist Leila Dean hails from Brighton, England. She says she's been an outspoken advocate and an independent spirit since her youth.
I think I was always predisposed to issues of justice. That started my life, and then I remember being, as a teenager, wanting to be a journalist. And the reason I wanted to be a journalist was because I wanted to uncover stories of injustice. So from there, I think I just merged into wanting to be out on the streets, directly confronting injustice and directly confronting those that were corrupt and were undermining the less able, the weaker in society. And I think that just turned into activism, which I then realised I could turn into a career as well. So this is really my ideal job, to be doing something that I was doing for free anyway. So that was why I started working voluntarily for the World Development Movement, not just on water privatisation, but on issues of finance, development, banks, spending money on trying to force countries into certain types of policy, and a whole range of issues, really. That was, for me, very close to my heart, but that was also where I recognised that all the hard work we'd been doing around poverty would be undone by climate change, and climate change was going to be something that would affect the poorest countries first and foremost. So I came to campaigning on climate change because I care about people and because I care about the inequality in the world. So yeah, I think all of that has led me to the place I'm in now at Greenpeace. And I did it because I knew the people and I knew that they were effective, because Greenpeace is one of the most effective environmental organisations and they really stand up for what they believe in. I would struggle to work in an organisation that wasn't willing to utilise all peaceful tactics to affect change, because the crisis that we see on our planet is so severe and we have so little time to affect change that we have to take all the actions we can take. So Greenpeace has an enormous reputation for getting in the way, and I'm inclined to do that when it's justified.
Leila leads the global campaign for Greenpeace against fracking, or hydraulic fracturing, the practice of using chemical-laden water to force fossil fuels out of the ground. Today, nearly all natural gas extraction involves fracking.
Yeah, I mean, fracking is just, you know, it speaks for itself, really, doesn't it? It's like we've drilled out everything we possibly could from this planet. We've exhausted so many different avenues for fossil fuels. So let's squeeze the last remaining drops from our earth at all costs. And a lot of people have stood up and said no. As the leader of the campaign in the UK, we've basically encouraged people to join up and say that they will not permit fracking under their property. So that would legally be trespass if the companies then went and fracked under their property. So actually we're trying to create a legal barrier to fracking. In Balcombe, which is a tiny village, one that people would assume was conservative and generally didn't take an interest in environmental stuff, there was a huge protest over the summer whereby environmental activists were joined by members of the community who came out to say, no, not in my backyard. And that was really powerful. I think the powerful thing about the fracking campaign is that it involves people from across the spectrum, everybody from older women who live locally to the young environmentalists to minority groups that are concerned. But yeah, we've been doing all kinds of humorous stunts in terms of fracking. For example, George Osborne is the Chancellor in the UK and he's been responsible for advocating fracking. And we went and fracked his village green. So he found a fracking rig right in front of his office one morning. Meanwhile, yeah, fracking is an issue globally in the US and in Australia. It's a line in the sand issue. It's an issue where people are saying no more. You know, my life and my planet has already suffered enough from this dependency on fossil fuels. And people know that there are alternatives, that there is a huge boom in the solar industry at the moment, that there is a lot of profit to be made from wind energy, both onshore and offshore. And they're demanding more from their federal and national governments than just allowing a load of cowboy companies to come in and frack the earth. Really, it's winning the knowledge war here at the moment and in the UK, because fundamentally nobody really knows what the impact is going to be. And so companies are putting out all kinds of nonsense facts and claiming that everything's going to be fine. And we have to keep challenging them and keep raising concerns around you know, making sure that they prove it first before they get to go anywhere near it. But as I say, fundamentally, we will never support fracking because we have to get off fossil fuels and we have to start here.
Leila has worked on other campaigns for Greenpeace, including the innovative Clean Our Cloud, targeting high-tech companies claiming to be green, but really causing a boom in the coal industry to power their data systems. Leila helped Greenpeace get Apple to commit to powering their upcoming new data system with renewable energy. She was also in the thick of the uproar over the Arctic 30, the Greenpeace protesters jailed by the Russian government in 2013.
We've had a very interesting few months as Greenpeace because we've been running an Arctic campaign for 2 years now. So calling on Shell and Gazprom to get out of the Arctic and calling on politicians to stop Arctic drilling permanently by creating a sanctuary so that we maintain the Arctic for all mankind rather than handing it over to oil corporations. For me, the most inspiring period I think I've ever had at Greenpeace has been the time that we were suffering from 30 people being put in prison by Russian authorities. And that was a result of them climbing onto an oil rig and trying to hang a banner. Now, we do actions like that all the time, and this was exactly the same as we did the year before. As far as I understand, Gazprom were on a very tight timeline to start drilling in the Arctic, and they had failed to be successful at getting oil repeatedly. And these companies have financial investors across the world that are ready to pull their money out at any point. And Arctic drilling is increasingly becoming a bad bet. And the financial community knows that. So Gazprom really has people to deliver to. In this case, it's a Russian government company. And certainly they weren't going to allow us to stand in their way of profit. So I think that's why they pulled us off. And I think that's why they were so keen to try and put us off ever doing it again. But actually, we really shone through that period because we're a global organization with offices in many countries. And the whole time they were in prison, the world was talking about Arctic drilling and talking about Gazprom and talking about what was wrong with drilling in the Arctic, certainly in a time of climate change. And that was really effective. And people were very brave. I think our executive directors were really brave. They literally had people's lives in their hands. And it made me proud to work for the organization.
Shell Corporation recently announced it would not be drilling in the Arctic in 2014 after a ruling in the Ninth Circuit Court in the U.S., which found that their permits were based on misinformation. It may be that Shell is doing just what Leila Dean and Greenpeace want them to do, taking a hard look at whether drilling in the Arctic is what the company should pursue. You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. Today's program is a collaboration with the Women Rising Radio Project. Visit womenrisingradio.com for special presentations related to this program. And for a CD copy of the program, call 800-529-5736. You can also visit us at radioproject.org. U.S.-born activist Leila Williams brings a unique perspective to Greenpeace. She's worked to strengthen indigenous voices and communities of color in creative collaboration with the group, which is still largely white and male at the top.
I would say that by default, being the only Black woman growing up in an all-white Jewish community and space, issues are just at the forefront, and you want to do something about those issues because they're directly affecting you. So I come from a family that's Muslim, Jewish, and Baptist Christians. We've got a lot there, and those multiple lenses, I think, are what defines my own activism because I'm constantly trying to grapple with the overlaps, the contradictions, the confluences of everything around me. I was part of an all-Black orchestra growing up, right? I started to actually travel with the orchestra to different countries. It was a really incredible program. And so they took the orchestra overseas, and I think we were about 14. It was a youth orchestra, and we had a kind of roundtable with Black and brown South African young musicians and we were talking about racial dynamics. That was probably the first time that I was really able to hear the way people were organizing around racial issues, and so many of the intersections in South Africa paralleled some of the intersections I was experiencing. And then I kind of learned a little bit about environment and biology when I got to school. And so I guess for me, it's always been that environment and race have been linked, but I wasn't able to express it or really communicate it. And then as I studied it and studied more and more, it was at the core of everything I was studying. So I originally studied biology, then environmental justice, environmental science and environmental justice. And I had the privilege to go overseas and study in the Amazon during college. I had the pleasure to go up and the privilege to go up and talk to Quilombo communities, runaway slave communities, and indigenous communities. And it's livelihood and ethnicity and survival, right? In tandem with or in conflict with extraction and degradation around them. They talked about it in those terms. They didn't separate environment and social justice, environmental justice, or their work and their culture and identity. And I'd say today also, the term environmental racism is not a super popular term, but I think it completely embodies what we're talking about here when we say climate change. There's a recent campaign called Climate Change is Racist. It's sometimes a hard sell to these dominant spaces, but, you know, it's very true.
Some folks want to be like an ostrich, bury their heads in the sand. Some hope that plastic dreams can unclench up those greedy hands. Some want to take the easy way, poisons and bombs, they think we need them. Don't they know they can't kill all the unbelievers? There's no shortcut to freedom. One blue sky above us, one ocean lapping all our shores. One earth so green and round, who could ask for more?
When I started finding out about environmental justice and environmental racism, I suddenly had something to research with in Google. And to learn more about the situations happening back home, across the country, and around the world. And so then I learned about the gas disaster in Bhopal, India, in 1984, when the Union Carbide Chemical Company had a disastrous spill, and Union Carbide got bought out by Dow Chemical. But it's a classic example of, frankly, and I'm going to use some strong language here, but kind of neocolonialism, right? Going overseas, land grabbing or situating oneself or one's company, extracting resources, or in this case, using it as a chemical facility to make pesticides for profit at the expense of local communities. And I had learned about what had happened there, and I'd heard about Greenpeace going to Bhopal and Greenpeace India having involvement around the Bhopal gas disaster. And I learned that they were working on toxics and there was an environmental justice component. And so I said, okay, I'm going to go intern. I want to find the people who worked on this. I actually went to Bhopal and volunteered there. But within the U.S. context, there was still a lot of divides, right, between environment and race and environment and social justice, not just at Greenpeace, but in a lot of big green spaces that I was finding myself in. And so during the years I was at Greenpeace, Greenpeace embarked on an internal journey to start to address these issues. And it's by no means over, and it will continue.
Greenpeace has launched the Democracy Initiative together with civil rights organizations like the NAACP on issues of environmental justice. In another move to bridge the racial and cultural divide, a new coalition, the Climate Justice Alliance, run by people of color, indigenous people, and frontline communities, has also come to sit at the table with Greenpeace, the Sierra Club, and other major players. Working with local communities of color, Lila achieved what she likes to call intersectionality when she joined the Greenpeace campaign to shut down Big Coal in Chicago. Lila was part of a diverse team that occupied the Pulaski Bridge, where they hung a Greenpeace banner.
So the Fisk and Crawford coal plants, two coal plants in Chicago, situated in Latino communities, lower income brown communities, churning out lots of coal and energy for everybody else, right? And this is towards the end of the campaign, kind of the last little push. And overall, it was agreed upon that, okay, this intense action will serve as a point of escalation to bring this into the media so that people really understand that these plants need to shut down. So one group went up a smokestack and painted quick coal, and that was at one of the coal plants. And then the other plant, which was right just next to the Pulaski Bridge, where barges of coal came up, that was my team. And so we dropped a banner to block a coal barge coming up. And it was the first time that I was arrested at that scale, and the first time that I had taken direct action using industrial climbing as a technique. It was definitely intense. You know, I'd say the moment where you get out of the car and climb over that bridge and tie your knots in is a really intense moment, really exhilarating moment. That's also a really intense but really positive feeling to know that I have my safety in my own hands, and then to also be working together. I mean, all the climbers were women, so that was also really lovely. And we had anchor support, who are the folks who are making sure that our anchors are secured and tied and engaging with the police so that they don't cut our ropes, things like that. You know, we're a mixture of men and women, but it was really lovely to, you know, rappel down, pop that banner, and then be along my sisters, right? The banner drops are not just to drop a banner, but it's really about, it's a messaging, it's a direct communication. The direct action part was around blocking this barge, you know, for however many hours. I think we were hanging there for at least a few.
The Fisk and Crawford coal plants were shut down shortly after that action. Even the Chicago Tribune noted that they were among the state's largest emitters of toxic chemicals. Lila credits the grassroots leadership working with Greenpeace on the plant's shutdown. She cites the banner that she and her team hung off the Pulaski Bridge in both Spanish and English as an example of including the community in the environmental struggle, which affects everyone. Since then, Lila co-created a special exhibit on the Rainbow Warrior while the ship was docked in San Francisco. The show, called Art and Resistance, featured activists, or artivists, as Lila likes to call them, from communities of color, indigenous communities, and women's collaboratives. You can see some of the work of these artists on the web at womenrisingradio.com.
One blue sky above us, one ocean lapping all our shores, one earth so green and round, who could ask for more? And because I love you, I'll give it one more try to show my rainbow ways. It's too soon to die. And because I love you, I'm gonna give it one more try to show my rainbow ways. It's too soon to die.
That's it for this Women's Desk edition of Making Contact. These profiles of international changemakers were produced by the Women Rising radio series, a project of Crown Safira Productions. You can learn more about the work of these courageous women at radioproject.org. Special thanks to Kat Clark and the staff of Greenpeace. Music courtesy of the Charlie Hunter Trio, Hallie Lauren, Sea Bible, and Dennis Hart. Shora Zamani is our engineer, Lynn Feinerman is our producer, and I'm your host, Sandina Robbins.